You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the RSA. My name is Vicky Hayward, and I'm the chairman of the RSA. It is my very great pleasure to be able to welcome one of the world's most distinguished political scientists to this event this evening, Robert Putnam. He's spent much of his career talking about social capital and the ties that bind communities together. He's the recipient of many international scholarly honours. He's an advisor to presidents, to prime ministers, and to public leaders worldwide. Professor Putnam holds a chair in public policy at Harvard University, and in his books include the best-selling Bowling Alone, The Collapse and Revival of American Community, and Making Democracy Work, both of which are amongst the most cited publications in the social sciences in the last half century. Since 2010, Professor Putnam has been focused on one major empirical project: inequality and opportunity, the growing class gap amongst American young people, and the implications for social mobility. His book on this subject, Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis, was published earlier this year to widespread acclaim. In his lecture this evening, Professor Putnam will share the key insights from this work and explore the cultural and economic factors that are contributing to the persistence of inequality, and consider what practically can be done to address the widening opportunity gap that is locking so many people, and particularly young people, out of a better future. And this is a subject that is very dear to the heart of the RSA. It was actually raised as a question specifically earlier on at our AGM. And we are fascinated to hear your views, Professor Putnam. Thank you very much.
Thank you all. Thank you all. Thank you. It's very good for me to be with you this evening. I appreciate your dedicating an hour or so of your time to a discussion of what I believe is, in my country, the most serious domestic issue that faces us, not only now, but over the next several decades. I have no idea whether what I'm going to say has any relevance at all to this country. It's possible that it won't, in which case you should consider this an evening spent learning about the strange customs of a weird tribe in the North American wilderness. But it may be that some of the things I'm saying will have resonance in this country too. I'd like to begin by, at the 30,000-foot level, talking about how American society has changed over the last 30 or 40 years, and then coming down pretty quickly to some discussions of the implications of those changes for the next generation. Lots of good things have happened in American society over the last 30 or 40 years. We are a less racist society than we used to be, still racist in important respects, as you've been able to observe on your television screens watching scene after scene of horrible racist violence in the cities and in the encounters between non-whites and policemen, but still a less racist society. And so the trend, at least, has basically been in the right direction. The trend with respect to the role of women in American society has, of course, been strongly in an egalitarian direction. We have niftier telephones than we did 50 years ago. So lots of big changes, and many of them for the good. But there's been one big change that is very striking, very pervasive, and I believe very dangerous. And that is that over the last 30 or 40 years, America has become a much more class-divided society than we were when I was growing up in America. Class-divided in a number of senses. First of all, the one that probably is most obvious to you is that the level of income inequality in America, among the level of income inequality among adults or among families, has become much greater inequality. There's been a lot of discussion about this, of course, all over the Western world. Piketty's book has called attention to this. if you imagine all American adults lined up here across the front of the stage, and we have over here the really rich folks, rich Americans. This is going to be the rich end of the room for tonight. And so Bill Gates is over there. Fortunately, my son is right here. Those are the wealthy folks. And then here we have the middle-income people, and as we move down to this end, I'm sorry, this is going to be the impoverished end of the room. Over there against the wall, we have homeless people or people without income. And what's happened in terms of income distribution over the last, especially the last 30 years, is that these folks over here have gotten a lot wealthier and have higher incomes, but Americans from about here down to the bottom have not had a raise for the last 30 years. So that's the first and most widely discussed kind of inequality. And I'm going to talk some about that. It's an important part of the background story to what I'm going to talk about. But that's not the only way in which America has become more class divided than it used to be. Actually, a really important trend that's not so well known, even in America, is that we've become a more segregated society. We're not more segregated in all terms. We're much less segregated in religious terms than we used to be. It used to be we had Catholic neighborhoods and Protestant neighborhoods and Jewish neighborhoods and so on. Now we're all mixed up in religious terms. We're a less segregated society in terms of race than we used to be. Not perfectly unsegregated, of course, but the trend line is toward more racial mixing in terms of where we live. But we're a much more segregated society in terms of income, education, and social class. More and more Americans are either living in rich enclaves, all of you folks over here on the rich side are living together more and more with each other, and more of the poor folks are living only with other poor folks, and fewer of us are living in mixed or moderate income neighborhoods. And that has powerful implications for who we know, for whom our children go to school with. So increasingly, kids coming from this part of the income distribution are going to school only with other affluent kids, kids from affluent homes, and kids, increasingly, kids from impoverished homes or even just lower income homes are going to school only with other middle, lower income kids, and fewer of our schools mix people across class lines. Where there's another indicator that's actually kind of an interesting indicator of how the society is pulled apart in social class terms. We're less likely to marry people from a different social class than we used to be. We're actually more likely to intermarry across religious lines, much more. There's much more interreligious intermarriage than there used to be. There's significantly more racial intermarriage than there used to be, but there's much less class intermarriage than there used to be. And intermarriage is actually a more interesting sociological indicator than you might think, fundamentally because we tend not to marry people whom we've not met. Thank you. That was a joke. I wasn't sure whether the Royal Society of Arts did jokes. That was a joke. There will be others. But what I mean is that when the measure of intermarriage across some line goes up, as it has, for example, in race in America, what that reflects is the fact that among people of marriageable age, teenagers and people in their 20s and 30s, there's more contact across racial lines, and therefore sometimes sparks fly and people form couples. And conversely, and this is the important point about the declining intermarriage across social class lines, when intermarriage across a given line declines, that actually represents the fact that people are less likely to encounter one another across the class line, and therefore it's a silent but quite powerful indicator of the ways in which our lives are increasingly defined by social class terms. So, first big change of this changing class structure in America is greater income disparities. Second big change is more segregation in many different ways, more segregation, rich folks only with rich folks, only with poor folks. And another third important change is that the what used to be quite powerful social and family and community bonds in working class neighborhoods, what we used to call the working class, that is sort of this part, the lower third of the society, used to be very powerful family and community bonds, religious bonds and so on within the working class. Those have mostly collapsed over the last 30 or 40 years. You can see this quite strikingly in one indicator that's relevant to kids, and that is family stability and the prevalence of single-parent families. Over here in the college-educated section, this is the upper third of American society, people who've gotten a college degree. That's basically tonight when I talk about rich folks, I'm loosely speaking about people who've gone to college, have finished college. That's the upper third of American society. Can I see the hands of all those in the room who have a college degree? So when I say rich, I mean you. And the lower third over there are this is a very affluent group, but the lower third of American society have only a high school degree or less. That's what I'm trying to, I'm not just in these remarks, not comparing Bill Gates' kids to some homeless kids. I'm comparing the upper third to the lower third. And in the upper third, among college-educated Americans, the rate of marital stability and having two parents, kids having two parents, is actually higher than it has been for many years and has not been declining almost at all. In the 1950s and 1960s, only about 6% of kids from college-educated homes had a single parent, and now that's about 8%. So there's been essentially flat level of stability. There was a bit of a period of divorce epidemic in the 1980s, but that's gone. So kids growing up in this part of the class structure are very, very, very likely as ever, to have two parents, whereas kids growing up here are not. 30 or 40 years ago, only about roughly 15% of kids growing up in the working class had a single parent, mostly a single mom, and now that's about 70%. 70% of kids growing up in the former working class are in single-parent families. And I have to be clear, I want to be clear because I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm not making a moral point about that. And I'm certainly not blaming the moms. The moms are often doing a terrific job in the face of serious challenges in their lives, economic and other challenges in their lives. But I am saying, and I'm on the left politically, that the fact of the matter, all the research shows that it's easier to raise a child or more than one child if there are two parents in the home rather than just one parent. And that means that the fundamental collapse of the working class family in America has a powerful effect on what I'm going to be talking about this evening. And I should say, because once upon a time, people looked at these data a few years ago, saw that this looked as if it were concentrated among black families and talked about the collapse of the black family in America, but it turns out that was a wrong independent variable. This was not caused by race. It was caused by poverty. And now there are a lot more poor white people as well as poor non-white people. And we can now see it's mostly about class, not mostly about race. There are still some racial differences, and I don't mean to be obscuring the fact there are important racial differences in America, but what I'm going to be talking about, the growing class gap, is really a class issue mostly and not mostly a racial issue. Okay, so the big picture that I've tried to lay out is this general trend in America toward class disparity in terms of income, in terms of where we live and who we hang out with, and in terms of the degree of social community family structure in our lives. And what I want to go on to say, and I'm going to say it really relatively quickly, I say it at much greater length in the book, is that on a lot of quantitative measures, you can see the result of these changes that I've described as a growing gap between rich kids who are doing better than ever and poor kids who are doing worse than ever. I'm going to be showing you or talking about a series of what we call scissors graphs. They look like this, in which we trace over the last 30 years how kids from affluent homes have been doing, and they're basically doing better and better, and how on the same measures kids from impoverished homes are doing, and they're doing worse and worse, and that produces this scissors gap, and that in turn produces, and will be the bottom line of what I want to say, an opportunity gap. Increasingly, the most important decision that any child makes as far as his or her future, economically, socially, and so on, is the decision is the choice of parents. If you are smart and you choose college-educated parents, you're set for life. But if you're, you know, you were asleep on the day when parents were being chosen, or you, you know, kind of blew it off and said, I don't care, I'll take whatever you got there, and you end up with a high school-educated parent, your goose is cooked. You say goose is good? Okay. And that's sort of the basic, that's the bottom line. But rather than telling you about all the data that show that, what I want to do is tell you a story. And the story, I promise you, will turn out not to be just a random anecdote. It's a story of the history of a small town in the middle of America. It's a town in Ohio. It's a town called Port Clinton, Ohio. It's called Port Clinton because it's on Lake Erie, one of the Great Lakes in America. It's a town, was in the 1950s and still is, mostly white, a town of about 5,000 people. I know a lot about the history of this town because it's my hometown. I'm telling you the story of my own hometown. And I'm imposing that on you, I assure you, not because my hometown is bizarre, but because it turns out, shockingly, that my hometown is perfectly representative of what's happened in America over these years. So when I was growing up in Port Clinton in the 1950s, it was sort of, you know, there was nobody very rich in town, nobody very poor in town. It was a modest town. Of my high school, I graduated from Port Clinton High School in 1959. Of my classmates' parents, nearly half had not completed high school. They had not completed secondary school. So this was a pretty modest town. And as I say, nobody very rich, nobody very poor. And now, 50 years later, we know how well that class did in life. And what we know, startlingly, is that that class was amazingly successful. 80% of us got more education than our parents and did better economically than our parents. And the kids coming from the wrong side of the tracks have done just about as well as the people coming from the right side of the tracks. There was very little class bias, it turns out, in the results of these lives of these kids 50 years later. One of the most startling examples of that are the two black kids in my class. They did face racism. This is the 50s. So they did face racism, serious racism in Port Clinton, not violent racism, but serious racism. Both of them came from very modest homes. Nobody in either of their homes had ever gotten past the third grade, that is basically 8 years old education. Both these kids graduated from high school. That's a big deal, from third grade to high school in one generation. Both of them got fellowships to go to college. Now we're talking serious upward mobility. Both of them graduated from college. Both of them went to graduate school. Both of them graduated from graduate school and had serious professional careers. Now, I'm not, of course, saying there was no racism in Port Clinton. On the contrary, there was serious racism. But that makes it even more startling that their class origins had very little negative effect on their life chances. I'm not claiming that that's typical of all Americans of color in the 1950s. Of course not. But I'm trying to illustrate that Port Clinton in those years, in fact, empirically, and this is not my Golden Glow remembrance, this is what the data show, was a remarkably equal opportunity place. Now, so I went to college on a fellowship from a local employer, met a girl there, really attractive, smart young woman. We've now been hanging out together for the last 54 years. So far, so good. We had two terrific kids, both of whom went to Harvard, both of whom went to graduate school. One of them is sitting right there. And they, in turn, had seven wonderful grandchildren. I want to show you the pictures of my seven grandchildren. And all of our grandchildren, without exception, are either now in one of America's best universities or headed there. And we're very proud of them. One of them is a young woman named, our oldest granddaughter named Miriam. Miriam is in her last year at a great college in America, and she's studying French literature. She spent summer before last in Paris studying, or so she said, studying French cuisine and French architecture. And I'm very proud of her. Meanwhile, back in Port Clinton, there was another guy named Joe. I did not play football with Joe because Joe was a couple of years behind me, but I might have. Joe decided not to go to college, but he got a really good job in a manual job in one of the factories in town. Port Clinton was a town that had some small auto parts factories and some mines, a few mines, and people, the dads of my classmates were fishermen on Lake Erie or manual workers or small businessmen like my dad. Joe's came from a working class background and, in fact, became a very successful member of the working class. He had two kids, just like me. His kids graduated from Portland High School, and then the bottom fell out. The bottom fell out of the Port Clinton economy, and the bottom fell out of the American working class. Joe's kids have never held a steady job. They've, in their lives, they've never gotten married, but that hasn't stopped them from having children. And I want to just read to you the field notes from one of my colleagues, Jen Silva, on this research team, her notes, field notes from meeting with one of Joe's grandchildren. Remember, now I've told you about my granddaughter, Miriam. Mary Sue is his granddaughter. That's not her real name, but that's what we call her. She is certainly a real person. And Mary Sue and Miriam are exactly the same age. They're both granddaughters of Port Clinton in the 1950s. Here's the notes. Mary Sue tells a harrowing tale of loneliness, distrust, and isolation. Her parents split up when she was 5, and her mother turned to stripping and left her alone and hungry for days. Her dad hooked up with another woman who hit her, refused to feed her, and confined her to her room with baby gates. Caught trafficking marijuana at 16, Mary Sue herself spent several months in a juvenile detention center, failed out of high school, and got a diploma in inverted commas, a diploma online. Her experiences have left her with a deep-seated mistrust of anyone and everyone, embodied in the scars on her arms, which we saw where a boyfriend had burned her in the middle of the night just a few nights earlier. Mary Sue wistfully recalls her stillborn baby, born when she was 13, since breaking up with the baby's dad, who left her for someone else, and with a second fiancé who cheated on her after his release from prison. Mary Sue is currently dating an older man with 2 infants born 2 months apart to 2 other women. And to Mary Sue, this feels like the best she can hope for. The story is actually even worse. Mary Sue, not long after we'd talked to her, told us what she thought was good news. Her older friend had said had found her a job working as a model in Toledo, which is a nearby industrial town. Even worse, Mary Sue posted on Facebook not long ago that she'd figured out her problems. Her problem, she said, is that no one in the world loves her, which is probably true, actually. And she's figured out how to solve that problem. Mary Sue's going to have a baby because the baby will love her. And if you think that Mary Sue is in a pickle, imagine Mary Sue's baby. It's hard for me to talk about this because Mary Sue and Miriam are exactly the same age. I'm really proud of Miriam, but she made one really smart decision. She chose college-educated parents in an era when that matters a lot. And she chose, by the way, great grandparents. Mary Sue has made only one mistake. Actually, she chose high school educated parents in a period in which the U.S. economy and the U.S. society was turning against what we used to call the working class. That's her only mistake. And from that decision, obviously, decision, I'm not joking exactly, flowed the fact that these two young women are living in different universes. Their futures are just unbelievably different. And yet they both come, in some sense, from the same background, except that, of course, the society has changed in the ways that I described earlier on. Now, Port Clinton, too, has changed. Basically, if you go to Port Clinton now, the older factories are still there. They're like ruins, like ruined cathedrals or something, surrounded by barbed wire and environmental protection signs on the barbed wire, and the downtown is a is a nightmare. There's of just boarded up shops. But Port Clinton has an advantage. It's located on one of the Great Lakes, on Great Erie. It's got a beautiful site. When I was growing up, that was mostly orchards, fruit orchards, and fishing camps. But now, if you go to Port Clinton, along the shore of Lake Erie is essentially one long gated community, 20 miles long and 150 yards deep, of million-dollar mansions. And those are beautiful homes. But the kids growing up there are just living in a different universe from people just a few hundred yards away. Indeed, there's a street in Port Clinton. If you go down East Harbor Road and you look to the left toward the lake and toward that gated community, the million-dollar mansions, the child poverty rate in that census tract is zero. There are no poor kids living in that census tract. Not a surprise, they're million-dollar mansions. But if you look to the other side of the road, just across the road, you see dilapidated double-wide mobile homes and shacks, which is where Mary Sue lives and grew up, in which the child poverty rate is 50%, 50%. Right there, in this tiny little town. I'm not talking about Los Angeles, or, I mean, it would be true in Los Angeles, and it would be true in New York, but I'm talking about just a little town. And the point I'm making, I hope this is clear, is not there's something unique about Port Clinton. There isn't. That there isn't anything. That even in a little town like this, American society has become so divided that the futures of kids coming from one side of the tracks and futures of kids coming to the other side of the tracks are essentially incomparable. Now, you'll think, come on, Putnam, stop giving hyperventilating about, sob stories from your hometown. And I have to go on to say, therefore, that we've done the same field research in Orange County, California, just south of Los Angeles, and in Philadelphia, and in the suburbs of Boston, and at Atlanta, and in Austin, Texas, heart of the new economy, and in Duluth, Minnesota, and Bend, Oregon, all over the country. And there are Mary Sues in every part of America. And there are Miriams in every part of America. And that's basically the story I want to tell. Now, if we had more time, and if this were a quantitative audience, I mean, maybe you are, in which case, get the book, because there's a lot of data in the book. And if you're not a quantitative person, just for the next 2 minutes, just, zone out. And trust me, I know this is a British audience, so trust is high, and you will trust me. Because what I'm going to quickly describe is a series of these scissors graphs. Remember I talked about the scissors graphs? And I'm now just going to run through the things on which you can see these growing gaps. Parents can invest two things in their kids. They can invest money and they can invest time. If I showed you the graph for investments of money in their kids for summer camp and piano lessons and computer games and hockey sticks and all that kind of stuff, that's gone up a lot. So the average well-off family in America spends $7,000 a year on their kids for summer camp and piano lessons and so on. But the same figure has been totally flat for people down at the bottom of the income hierarchy. They are now spending only about $700 a year. It didn't used to be that big. Huge gap, scissors graph. And so don't think about that in terms of money. Just think about it in terms of all those missing piano lessons and missing summer camps. Similar graph, more important in a way than the money is time with kids. You can parents spending time with kids. Actually, parents spend time with kids in basically two ways: physical upkeep, which we loosely call diaper time, and interacting with the kids in a developmental way, which we call a goodnight moon time, based because there's American. I don't know if it's published in Britain or not, but there's the most popular American kids' book is called Goodnight Moon. So there's been no change over time in diaper time. Diaper time is flat, no increase in productivity of diaper time, and there's no class difference, actually, in diaper time. It takes just as long to change a rich diaper to a poor diaper. But there's a big gap. Didn't used to be a gap in Goodnight Moon time, but now there's a big gap in Goodnight Moon. So across America, because it's grown so much more for my grandchildren and their peers, the Miriams of the world, remember Miriam is my granddaughter, the Miriams of the world are getting 45 minutes a day more goodnight moon time, more parental reading to their kids and playing patty cake and going to the zoo and so on, 45 minutes a day more than Miriam's of the, than the Mary Sue's of the world. And if you think that's irrelevant, it's because you don't yet know the most recent brain science on pediatric neurology and infant brain development, because what we now know is the human brain does not develop like a mushroom in a dark room slowly developing all by itself. No, the human brain is programmed to develop through a process of social interaction. It's what the pediatric neurologists call serve and response, like in ping pong or in tennis. So the child emits some signal like, ooh, and the adult returns by saying, isn't she sweet? And then the child says, ooh, 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 and the adult says, just like my mother. Do you see what I mean by the ping pong? And so Miriam got lots of reading time from her parents and from her grandmother and occasionally even me. And so, but before she was even 3 or 4 years old, she had gotten a whole lot of brain development time from her parents. And Mary Sue, sitting alone in the room, did not get that. And it sounds like I'm joking about that. I'm not. It's deeply tragic. Because what we know is IQ is affected by that. And another one of these scissors graphs that we can see in the data is a growing gap in test scores between rich kids and poor kids. And that growing gap is fully large before the kids get to school. This is not a story mainly about schools. This is mainly a story about what happens to kids 0 to 5. And because of the changes in American society that I've described, what happens to kids between 0 and 5 is increasingly class differentiated. You can see similar graphs in the amount of time that parents spend with their kids at dinner, having dinner together, family dinners. Family dinners are a little bit out of fashion. Do you know what I mean by a family dinner? I'm not talking about, no, this is not Christmas. I'm talking about just, well, there's a gap like that. Increasingly rich folks, not increasingly, but rich folks have dinners with their families steadily as they have been for a long time. Poor kids don't. That's dropping. Not because the poor families sort of don't like having dinner, but because as one of the characters in the book that's my favorite character, a real working-class black woman from Atlanta, said, honey, we ain't got time for any of that how's your day stuff here. And I hope it's clear, I'm not making fun of her. I'm sympathizing with her. She's working hard to try to keep her family together. But what that means is no cultural capital is the way sociologists would talk. No, none of this discussion over the dinner table. Similar graphs like that in what we call extracurricular activities, band, chorus, football, French club, baseball. Steady and high participation rates among the rich kids of America, sharply declining rates among the poor kids of America. And if you think that's a trivial observation, you don't know what the data show, because the data show that taking part in extracurricular activities is, in fact, independently a powerful predictor of lifetime income, controlling for other stuff. Because, in effect, what taking part in extracurricular activities does is teach kids soft skills that employers are willing to pay for. And therefore, the fact that there's a sharp decline in extracurricular activities among working-class kids, football or whatever, is actually not a trivial thing. It's a big deal. And you might say, well, how did that happen? Why are there not any more participation than there used to be? And the answer is, we did that. Because about 20, 25 years ago, American school districts began charging kids. It's called pay to play. If you want to take part in extracurricular activities, your parents have to pay, on average, $800 a year. If you've got two kids, $1,600. If your annual income is $200,000, $1,600 is not. It's trivial, right, for your kids? But if your annual income is $16,000, who in their right mind is going to pay 10% of their total family income so your kids can play football? Answer, almost nobody. And that's why that's declining. It's the privatization of activities that a generation ago, everybody in town paid so that every kid in town could play football. And that's changing. Similar graphs like this for other community involvement. Church involvement, for example, looks like that. Didn't used to be. It used to be working-class kids were as likely to be in church as middle-class kids. And why do I use churches? Not for theological reasons, but because that's an example of a place in which a generation ago, two generations ago, there were adults outside the immediate family who were paying attention to kids. And the most important feature of life as a poor kid in America today Bar none is that poor kids are isolated and alone. And they don't trust anybody. They don't trust their parents because their parents are living complicated lives. They don't trust schools. They don't trust anybody. Mary Sue recently posted on Facebook, "Love hurts. Trust kills." Think what it means to grow up in a society in which you cannot trust anyone. Here's a way of thinking about that that may make sense to you in your own personal experiences. I begin with the premise that all kids do dumb things. Rich kids, poor kids, black kids, white kids, American kids, I suppose English people as kids do dumb things. If that's, maybe I'm wrong about that. Raise your hand if as a youngster you never did a dumb thing. That's what I thought. So when a kid from an affluent background now in America does some dumb thing, they drink too much or they get involved in drugs or they have a bad romantic alliance or they insult a teacher or they back the car into the next door neighbor's car. When our kids do that, instantly airbags inflate to protect our kids from the worst features of that and make it a learning experience. That's what I'd do if one of my grandchildren, we discovered, thank God it hasn't happened, but if we discovered one of our kids was involved in drugs, the first thing I'd do is find the best lawyer in town, and the second thing I'd do is find the best rehabilitation facility in town. That's what you do as a parent. You try to protect your kids, and they've got to learn, but now you have to imagine the same exact dumb thing being done by a poor kid in America today. No airbags. No learning opportunities. These kids are alone. Now, if we had more time, I'd talk about all of the other things that distinguish the lives of rich kids and poor kids in America that do distinguish those lives now but didn't a generation ago. And we'd talk about why that has happened. There are a lot of different specific reasons. The income gap is part of it. The segregation is part of it. Schools actually are not part of the cause of the problem. I know that RSA has been involved in schools. I'm not saying schools are not a place we could begin to address the problem. But this is not a problem we should blame on schools. Americans have a bad habit of blaming all the problems that we create on schools and then complaining because the schools don't solve them. This is not a schools problem. This is an us problem. And indeed, that's the underlying cause here. Us. When my parents in Port Clinton in the 1950s used the expression, "our kids," we ought to pay higher taxes here so that our kids can have a swimming pool. They didn't mean a swimming pool for my sister and me in our backyard. They meant that all the kids in town, all of our kids, deserve a swimming pool. And they kept paying higher taxes so that all of our kids could have a swimming pool or a French department or a new gymnasium or whatever, even after my sister and I were long gone. But over the course of the last couple of generation or two in America, the meaning of our kids has shriveled. Our sense of who counts as one of our kids has shrunk. So that now when you talk to people in Port Clinton about Mary Sue, they say, well, she's not one of our kids. She's somebody else's kid. Let them worry about her. And that change is wrong. And it's had huge effects, demonstrable, measurable effects. You can see it not least in who gets a college degree in America today. If you look at who gets a college degree depending upon, A, how smart they are, as measured by mathematics tests at age 12, and B, how rich their parents are, you're not surprised to learn that rich, smart kids are very likely to complete college. You're probably disappointed but not shocked to learn that poor, dumb kids don't mainly graduate from college. But how about the people of the other two categories? How about smart, poor kids? Of them, 29% get a college degree. And how about challenged rich kids? And of them, 30% get a college degree. I mean, that is just directly contradictory to the idea of meritocracy. Your parents' income is more important than how smart you are, how good you are. The reason I mention that statistic is because it captures the fact that this is not costly for American, this is not cost-free for American society, and this is surely not a zero-sum game. It's not that my Miriam will be better off if we just let Mary Sue, live in squalor. my Miriam will be better off if we invest more in Mary Sue, because in the aggregate, failing to invest in poor kids and other people's kids means that we have lots of people who are really smart, demonstrably smart, but aren't able to get an adequate education and therefore not able to contribute to the economy as a whole. The best econometric estimate is that the cost of the American economy over the course of the lifetime of the current generation of poor kids is about, of failing to invest in them, is about $5 trillion. Trillion with a T, that's a lot of money. It's partly because of the cost of criminal justice, it's partly because of health costs, which are going to be much higher for these poor kids because they live very unhealthful lives. But it's mostly because of the opportunity costs. We're just throwing away, as a country, lots of our most talented kids. And that's DUMB. That's the problem. I can't forbear. I know I've talked a little too long at you, but I just want to say one last thing, because I will have given the impression so far that I'm deeply pessimistic about America. That's not true. And the reason that I'm actually somewhat optimistic about America being able eventually to address this problem is that we have done so before. America has been in exactly this situation about 100 years ago. We had a big gap between rich and poor. It was the period in American history called the Gilded Age, around 1800, 1890-1900. Piketty's work shows that in Britain and America and so on, that was the maximum peak of economic inequality until we got to now. So we were very unequal, and we had a huge wave of immigration at that point, lots of foreigners coming in who were making everybody else uneasy, people from, you know, Italy and Ireland and Jews from Russia and so on. It was a period of great political alienation. Political corruption was probably higher then than even now. A sense that our country was falling apart and we didn't know how to fix it. Worse yet, a public philosophy that was called social Darwinism. Maybe you know a bit about social Darwinism here. It actually originated here. Social Darwinism was a trumped-up theory meant to be scientific, the bottom line of which in social policy was everybody in America would be better off if we were just selfish and let the devil take the hindmost. And if you think there's some parallels between that public philosophy and the current public philosophy in America, that's not an accident. And then we began to fix the problem. In a pretty short period of time, around 1900, Americans first of all recognized that we did have this problem. A Danish-American journalist wrote a famous book in American history called How the Other Half Lives. And it was just a description of life in the slums of the Lower East Side of New York, intended to be read and actually read by the rich folks in the silk stocking districts of the Upper East Side of New York. And the basic point of this book was, look, to the readership was, look, do you realize how the squalor in which people are living just 10 miles away? And of course, some of the rich folks said, sure, well, you know, it's their fault. Let them worry about it. But some people, some affluent Americans began to worry about what was happening to America. And gradually, I'm simplifying, you know, a two-hour lecture here into about three sentences. But gradually, Americans began to recognize we had to do something about it, and a whole lot of reforms came out of that, child labor laws and minimum wages and so on. But the most important reform, and this is where I want to end, the most important reform was that in 1910, in response to a problem situation very much like the current one, Americans invented the high school. The first time in world history in which all kids in town were given a free public secondary education just because they were kids. And this reform did not come from Washington, and it did not come from Harvard, and it did not come from Boston or the other metropoles in America. It came from small towns, mostly in Midwest. And the pitch you had to make to the local affluent lawyer and banker and rich farmer was, who had already paid for their kids to get a private secondary education, and their kids were off at Chicago making lots of money, the pitch was, you should pay higher taxes so that other people's kids can get a secondary education. Not an easy pitch. But it turned out to be the best decision that Americans have ever made. I mean that. because that decision, having universal secondary education publicly provided, even though it was costly in the short run, it was a big investment, the economic historians now tell us that that was responsible for most of American economic growth throughout the 20th century, because it instantly raised the level of human capital in the American economy. Our workforce became gradually more and more better trained because of this free public secondary school. I mean, I know that seen from London, the two wars must have had something to do with the growth of the relative growth of the American economy, and I don't want to deny that, but actually the best econometric evidence is this universal free secondary education was the biggest single explanation. And simultaneously it leveled the playing field. It's a twofer. It did things that you normally don't have. That is, it was good for poor people and at the same time good for everybody. Now, if we had more time, and this was a policy talk, I'd spend a little more time asking what might be the 21st century equivalent of the high school. I'm inclined to think early childhood, publicly provided early childhood, high-quality early childhood education is one of my nominees for that. But the main point I want to make is a political point. The crucial in this area, this is not, I think, an issue of policy wonkery. I can list, if we have time, 6 or 7 things that we know would work to begin to help poor kids in America and to begin to narrow the opportunity gap. This is a question, this is a case in which the most important challenge, I think, is developing political will, putting this higher up the national agenda. Now, I'm just about to do a little bit of name dropping in that, but that's because I'm a Harvard professor. So Harvard professors do name drop. It's part of our requirement for the job. So I have talked to most of the candidates for President of the United States. They've come to me. I spent 2 hours talking to President Obama. I spent time talking to Jeb Bush and to other conservative Republicans. They came to me. Why? Not because I'm a major campaign contributor, not because I'm a pretty face or a celebrity. It's because they heard that I was working on this problem, and they recognize that this is a big deal. They don't agree at all on what's to be done about it. And I don't take their agreement or their calls to me as a sign we're on the road to fixing this. I do take it as a sign that this issue is rising higher up the national agenda. In the last time we faced this problem, it was not Washington that fixed it. It was small towns all across America. And that's my image of what we need now. We need a grassroots mobilization in America to begin to narrow the opportunity gap, to give all of our kids a fair chance at the American dream, and in the process, help the whole country move forward. You've been a terrifically tolerant audience. I'm very grateful to you for paying attention, and let's have some discussion.
Thank you so much, Robert. I suppose, and I don't mean this flippantly at all, but what struck me so much when I was reading your book was the fact that, you know, you guys spent an awful lot of time getting away from the British class system and the British class problem, and yet now we share so many issues. And everything that you are talking about is so relevant, I think, to the challenges that we're facing in the UK. And everything that you're talking about is so relevant to an organisation with 27,000 fellows who are committed to want to enrich society through ideas and action. And your call to a grassroots movement about this, I think, is very useful for us to consider, because we have been talking to those who make policy for quite some time. And indeed, as you say, under both political examples, actually poverty in this country has got worse, and indeed it has in the US. So this is a very pertinent time. Okay, so, and I'll take 4 questions and then we'll ask Robert to respond.
I'll stand up so you can see me. First of all, I want to thank you so much for the way in which you told a wonderful personal story that had us all hooked in to what you had to say. I thought that was fantastic. I want to move it up to a global level, though, because we've been looking, I'm working with some people looking at studying leadership, and for example, Bob Hawke, who was Prime Minister of Australia, they asked him what was the best decision you ever made in his years as Prime Minister. He said, choosing my parents. and his parents were committed to education. And the other person in leadership is Julia Gillard, of whom you may have heard, and she said that she had fantastic parents, a great education, and when Gough Whitlam abolished university fees, her life journey became very different, and she became the first woman Prime Minister. She's now the chair of the Global Education Partnership. That's why I want to take it up a level. These are all our young people. She wants to get involved with the Obamas in educating children who are out of school throughout the world. And I think that relates to the sorts of things that we're involved in. Thank you.
Thank you. And another question.
Thank you. It was a fascinating lecture. Thank you very much for it. At the start, you referred to the fact that marriage was on the decline.
Among working class Americans.
Yes. But did you take into account the fact that so many youngsters today are not bothering to formally get married, but consider themselves as married when they're living in a partnership? And in addition, when you asked about those who'd got a university degree, did you consider the fact that there are many people who were not able to go to university because they couldn't afford it, but they still became professionals through studying in professional organisations?
Thank you very much. And the gentleman next to you.
Has the election of President Obama changed America's image in the world? That's the first question. The second question, what is the first item, the first thing Barack Obama has done for you to be remembered for?
Yes, a question about schools in America. Do you feel that the impact, or do you feel there's any impact with charter schools and KIPP schools have made on students with their sort of emphasis on getting to college, but not necessarily getting them finishing college?
Right.
Thank you.
Lots of really good questions. Thank you all. First of all, I'm glad to learn about the international initiative to focus on parents and education. I do think that my reading of the problem in America is that this is a purple problem. By that, I mean, you know that in American, maybe you don't know, but in America, we get it, we have the whole red and blue thing exactly backwards. We use red to mean conservative, that's nuts. And we use blue to mean progressive, which is equally nuts. I have spent most of my life studying British politics, so I know it's not right. But anyhow, Americans by red mean conservative, and by blue mean progressive. And this is a purple problem in the sense that parts of this problem you can understand most clearly if you use, as I would typically use myself, blue progressive lenses. You can see the effect of the factory closures and the collapse of the working class economically, and you can see the effects of that in Mary Sue's life. But parts of the problem you can actually understand, you can't understand unless you're using or willing to use red progressive conservative lenses, and that's especially about the collapse of the working class family. I don't mean to be now announcing my ideological conversion to conservatism. I'm only saying that this is a problem which you do need multiple lenses to be able to see what's going on. So it is partly about family. I'm back to the family. And it's mostly not about school. I have to keep saying that. This is not a problem that schools created. It's a problem that we might want schools to help fix, for sure. But that's different from saying that schools created the problem. I was asked the question about cohabitation. And I can answer that very quickly. Yes, we did very much take that into account. Cohabitation in Europe is sometimes just marriage without a license. It's not that in America. The research is quite clear. Cohabitation in America is not a stable, it's extremely rarely a stable marriage-like relationship. And it's especially rarely to be that among working-class people. These working-class families that I'm talking about that are 70% of them, very unstable, are really unstable and not just people living as if they were married but without the license. So this is cohabitation. We have carefully looked at that, and that's not the explanation for the pattern we find. Someone wondered about the use of education as my measure of social class. The reason I did that was just because it's convenient. You'd have the same basic patterns. Now, all of my graphs would look identical if we used income. The problem is that, just a methodological one, if you're talking to kids, kids rarely know reliably their parents' income, so you can't rely on what the kids say about their parents' income when you're trying to do the statistical analysis. Kids are much more likely to know their parents' education. And in America, at least, especially now, there's a very, very high correlation between education and income. So I recognize that it's possible to get a high, to do well in social class terms without a advanced education, and I recognize that it's possible to be poor and well-educated. But in fact, we've looked carefully at this. None of our findings turn on that issue of exactly how we measure social class. Charter schools are an interesting case. You put together the KIPP schools and charter schools. The KIPP schools, actually, the data show they do work. The KIPP schools are a particular brand of sort of like what you would call academy schools, I guess. And the KIPP schools are a particular brand of that, and they actually do work. But mostly charter schools don't work any better than... I mean, there are some great charter schools, and there are some great public schools. And there are some awful public schools, and there are some awful charter schools. This, what I'm just finished saying to you, is highly controversial, but that's my reading of the evidence. My reading of the evidence is that most of... We've been, and maybe you have too, engaged for the last 30 years in a great ideological debate about schools, most of which I think... Actually, I'm new to that debate. I wandered into the minefield without knowing what I was doing. But most of that, I think, actually, to my problem, which is the class gap, is not, frankly, all that relevant. There are things that are happening in schools that we could fix, but it's not just a matter of school governance, in my view. I'm not trying to make to enter into ideological debates here. Obama. Well, what a temptation. But I have to declare my bias right away. Actually, this is more name-dropping. I've known Obama before he was famous, because he was a member of a seminar that I ran at Harvard for a number of years. Also, and this will convince you how tight the American elite networks are, Obama, while he was in law school, played basketball with my son. So this is a very tight-knit little group. And that leads me to say, of course, I think Obama's done a terrific job as president. But I would say that with respect to equality, actually, even more firmly. And I think Obama's presidency was enormously hampered by the fact that he came into power just in the aftermath of the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, and by the fact that he's black. And I think both of those things have made it harder for him to govern effectively. Remember, you're hearing from a diehard Obama supporter here, but that's my take is that when we... 30 years from now, when we write the history of the first half of the 21st century, I think America will have actually turned the corner and become somewhat more egalitarian, at least in terms of opportunity. And I think Obama will turn out to be the president who presided over that inflection point when we turned. But, well, you know, can we all agree to gather here in 30 years? And
absolutely.
I'll be here.
And of course, his stated view is both. I mean, he gets the purple point. He says
he does, absolutely.
There are two points to this, and they have to come together. We cannot take a polarized position.
He also gets the other point, which is somewhat controversial, that this is both race and class.
Yes.
And but I now have gone way beyond what I should do in pretending that I'm unbiased. I didn't even pretend, actually, very well.
Okay, I'm going to take one more question. It's the lady there.
Thank you very much for the lecture. It's been fascinating, and I'm very excited. I'm very excited to hear that early childhood education is what you believe to be the next level playing field move for the 21st century. I'm also very interested to hear that you feel that it needs to be a grassroots initiative, bottom up. The reason why I'm so excited is because I actually work for an organisation that's works in the US but also in Europe, and we're starting to work more in communities to create programs that increase access to early childhood education.
Good.
My question is, what do you see the role of philanthropy and community foundations to be in catalyzing the shift towards access to education, early education for all? And is there a difference between what they can do at a national level, advocacy, as you say, in raising it up the agenda and catalysing actors together at a local level.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah. just to be clear, I did not plant that question. You and I have never met each other, I think.
That's how philanthropy works.
I think that voluntary action, I'm going to go beyond just philanthropy because I think voluntary action is really important. I say this not that voluntary action, or certainly not just philanthropy, can replace public action. I think we've got to be careful. I don't think this problem can be solved just by turning to philanthropy and volunteering. But I do think that's an important part of it. The volunteering part, I just want to say quickly, is because, of course, I do want to push early childhood education, but I also want to push mentoring. If you remember that the modal characteristic of poor kids in America is that they don't have any adult in their lives, any reliable adult in their lives, I think systematic, well-trained, and overseen volunteering by responsible adults is one important thing to address, to do to solve this problem. Because these kids, they don't have anybody to be a shock absorber or a guide or to say, you know, think about this or think about that. And I don't mean the mentoring in the sense of showing up once a week or once a month to, you know, say, how's your life going? I mean somebody who's in effect doing the same kind of things, if not a parent, then a loving uncle or aunt or neighbor. In the old days, somebody from church or another, just somebody a neighbor would have done. That's the kind of thing that I mean, serious, paying attention to other people's kids. But also I think that, to go to the final point I want to make about what you said, I absolutely do think that community foundations in particular, community foundations are, I think, a bigger deal in America than they are in Britain, although they're rapidly expanding. I know that in Britain. Community foundations are local, basically local organizations which get money from local philanthropists to distribute to solve local problems. And that, in a way, fits more easily with the highly decentralized feature of American society. But in the last 20 years, it's become more common in this country, too. And I think in America, often the community foundations, they're not all strong, but some of them are strong, and where they are strong, they can be the backbone of solving community problems. And so I want to give a particular example, because this also illustrates how I think, in a way, this problem is going to be addressed, and I hope solved. Over the last 8 months, my wife and I have been wandering back and forth across America, more or less nonstop, talking to local people about this problem. And we spent some time in Charlotte, North Carolina. Charlotte, North Carolina is a wealthy, Sunbelt city. It's also the most unequal city in America. The distribution of income is the most unequal, and the rate of upward mobility out of lower-class backgrounds is the lowest in America. And the leaders in the good town of Charlotte know that. And I met with, they formed a committee, a local leadership committee, which has some of the Charlotte is a banking community, so some of the local big bankers, who are actually also national bankers, as well as the mayor and the community, the head of the county council, and several pastors of some of the large churches, and other community groups are organized together as a group. The organizational backbone is a community foundation, but they've spent time trying to figure out, all they want to do is get Charlotte out of the cellar, out of the worst place in America. That they think that's not good. Not good for business, not good for anything. And they're trying to figure out practically what can they do. Now, there's some things they can't do there because it's national policy. They can't, you know, change the distribution of income in America. But some things they can do, like improvements in the schools, like a more serious mentoring program, like early childhood education for all kids. It's got to be, by the way, high-quality early childhood education. Low-quality early childhood education is not worth the money you spend on it, but high-quality is. That's what all of the evidence shows. I don't know whether the people in Charlotte will, in the end, fix the problem, because they're working against, actually, in their case, a couple hundred years of racial segregation, as well as the more recent class divisions. I don't know whether they're going to fix it. I have an admiration for their energy and their commitment. But what I do know is if the problem is going to be fixed in America, that's what it's going to look like. It's going to look like places like Charlotte beginning, and some of the places like Charlotte that are working on the problem, we'll screw it up, and we'll never hear from them again. But some of them will turn out to hit upon really right solutions, like the folks who invented the high school in these little towns in the Midwest in around 1910. That's the way America has a very decentralized system, very unlike Britain. So we don't fix problems by having a big national election and then the government deciding, the Houses of Parliament voting to fix that problem. Now we can do global warming or something. That's not the way we do it. I wish in some respects that I lived in Britain because I like that cleanness of making a national decision.
We don't fix our problems like that. We might think we do, but we don't.
That's a long answer to a very good question.
No, that is a brilliant answer. And as I understand it, you're coming to Oxford on a visiting lectureship.
I'm in Oxford this fall, Michaelmas term. I'm in Oxford. That young woman that I mentioned earlier on that I began to hang out with and I spent our first year of marriage living in a bedsitter on the ground floor on Iffley Road. Iffley Road, you might know because it's across from where Roger Bannister had just a few years earlier broken the four-minute mile. That's how old we are. So we're now 52 years later back. Enjoying Oxford.
I'm extremely pleased that you're doing so, and this has been the most fascinating evening, but I really should draw us to a close now. Thank you to everybody who's joined us online, and thank you to everyone here, but mostly thank you to you for such an inspirational evening. Professor Putnam.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you all.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.